Hello, this is Todd Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026, coming to you from my home studio. And we start on the front page, America 250. Patriotism shines at Veterans Park. Forsyth community comes together to make mosaic mural. And this article is by Valerie Wells, Forsyth. Life in a small town means that when you have a project, plenty of people pitch in to make it happen. The community mural in Veterans Pavilion in Forsyth was that project. The mural consists of more than 250 square tiles painted by residents, both big and small, and even a class of Stephen Decatur Middle School students popped in to paint some of them, especially when we did it at the library. Library Director Melanie Weigel would have settings where she'd put a time frame together. We're going to do this from 2 to 4. And 25 kids would show up, said Mayor Jim Peck. It's about community. The mural was unveiled on Saturday during Forsyth Fest, and the pattern for the mural, which is an American flag with the profile of a bald eagle as the focal point, surrounded by the hand-painted tiles, came from Mural Mosaic, with plenty of themes to choose from depending on the situation. Forsyth chose the flag because it's displayed in Veterans Pavilion in Forsyth Park. Plans are to refurbish the area around the pavilion, said Forsyth Administrator Jill Appleby, with an expanded area for memorial bricks, new landscaping, and stones to represent all the branches of the military. The work is slated to be complete in time for Veterans Day, November 11th, this year. The mosaic will remain in the pavilion, and the pavilion will not be changed during the rest of the upgrade of that part of the park. While they expect the tiles to be a sort of paint-by-number project, said Kim Taylor, who works for the Village of Forsyth and painted several of the tiles, they arrived blank. To keep the flag colors correct, volunteers had to use specific colors on their tiles, whether that was light blue, indigo, crimson, or cream, but they could freehand their own particular design onto the tile. Some have Bible verses, one has STL for the St. Louis Cardinals, which Peck joked was his grandson who hasn't been converted into a Cubs fan yet. There are fireflies and butterflies, a teddy bear, sunflowers, stars, a whale, Elvis Presley, and one was painted the word Coke. I did at least 6 or 7 in there, Taylor said. I did one for my grandsons who just lost their other grandma, the one up there with angel's wings. Jill Appleby did a jar with lightning bugs in it. My youngest grandson did the whale up there. It was a lot of fun. And I'll describe the mosaic. It truly is beautiful, what I'm looking at here. It's on Forsyth unveiled its community mural on Sunday, June 20th, with more than 250 hand-painted tiles. By residents, with a little help from Stephen Decatur Middle School art students. And it's gorgeous. The thing I notice is just the bald eagle popping out and then the flag in the background, but obviously made of the individual tiles. And when you look at the tiles themselves, they're just beautiful how it's put together in the right colors. Truly an impressive piece of art. Valerie Wells, Photos, Herald and Review. Iran VP says talks set roadmap to peace. Vance negotiations laid a good foundation for a final agreement. This article is by Humera Pamuk, Dave Graham, and Tala Ramadan, Reuters, Bergenstock, Switzerland. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance said Monday talks with Iranian officials in Switzerland laid a good foundation for a final peace deal, despite tensions over the Strait of Hormuz and Lebanon. The two sides, trying to build on an interim deal signed last week, agreed to a roadmap towards a permanent agreement within 60 days at the talks in the Qatari-owned Swiss mountain resort of Bergenstock. Mediators, Pakistan and Qatar, said They also agreed on a mechanism to end the fighting in Lebanon between U.S. ally Israel and Iran-aligned Hezbollah, and opened a communications line to help ensure safe passage for commercial ships through the strait, a vital global oil supply route. Optimistic assessment. Vance claimed Tehran agreed to allow in nuclear inspectors and to establish mechanisms to handle its assets frozen abroad and manage ceasefires. We laid a very good foundation for a successful final deal, he told reporters after taking part in the talks. But Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Esmail Baghaei told the official IRNA news agency Monday that Tehran did not negotiate on its nuclear program and did not accept any new commitments in Sunday's talks. Iran's interactions with the International Atomic Energy Agency will continue in accordance with current procedures, subject to the approval of Iran's parliament and the decisions of the Supreme National Security Council, Baghaei said. Since the U.S. bombed Iran's nuclear facilities in June last year, Iran let the IAEA inspect only facilities that weren't attacked in those strikes. The IAEA halted inspections completely after the U.S.-Israeli strikes that began the war with Iran on February 28th, and they have not resumed since. U.S. President Donald Trump threatened Sunday to restart the war after Iran again closed the Strait of Hormuz, citing Washington's failure to halt the fighting in Lebanon. Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on social media that Tehran secured waivers for oil and petrochemical exports, the release of some of its frozen assets abroad, and the launch of a reconstruction and development plan for Iran. Vance said White House envoy Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, came up with a process where the U.S. and Qatar would have control over Iranian funds when they are unfrozen that would allow the money to be spent on U.S. corn, soy, and wheat. The U.S. Treasury Department issued a general license for Iran on Monday, authorizing the production, delivery, and sale of crude oil and petrochemical and petroleum products of Iranian origins through August 21st. Oil prices, technical talks were due to continue for the rest of this week, and Pakistani Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif wrote on social media that the first round of talks concluded successfully. The discussions were held in a positive and constructive atmosphere and yielded encouraging progress, he said. Oil prices rose sharply when Tehran started blockading the Strait of Hormuz, prompting a U.S. blockade of Iranian ports, but fell after last week's interim deal to their lowest since the war began. Oil prices dipped further after Monday's joint statement by Qatar and Pakistan, with worries about a supply shortage in global markets easing and global benchmark Brent crude trading below $80 per barrel. Before Sunday's talks officially began, Fox News quoted Trump as saying he had told Iranian officials, "You won't have a country if they tried to close the strait again." Iran's semi-official Tasnim news agency, citing an informed source, said that after Trump's threats became public, the Iranian delegation refused to return to the room where talks were held, though messages were traded via the mediators. The MOU calls for reopening the Strait of Hormuz and ending all hostilities, including in Lebanon, where violence continued despite a ceasefire declared Friday. Accusing the U.S. of failing to meet its commitment to halt fighting in Lebanon, Iran said at the weekend that it again stopped maritime traffic throughout the strait, but ship tracking data showed two crude tankers with just under 2 million barrels of oil sailed through the strait Monday, a sign that traffic is picking up again, even though the sailings through Hormuz are still a fraction of the average daily crossings of 125 vessels before the Iran war began. Violence in Lebanon. Thousands of people have been killed in the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, mostly in Iran and Lebanon, where Hezbollah opened fire in support of Iran On March 2nd, the violence in Lebanon abated since last Saturday, with security forces saying Israel's last airstrike was on Saturday evening. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun discussed efforts to maintain the ceasefire and halt Israeli military escalation during a phone call with Vance, Qatari Prime Minister, and Kushner, the Lebanese presidency said. Train fare on track for return to Decatur. Scott Perry, Decatur. After a four-year pause, the Decatur train fare is returning to the Decatur Civic Center on Saturday and Sunday, June 27th and 28th. The 2026 train fare will feature four operating model railroad layouts and over 100 tables of railroad-related collectibles, making the fare a major destination for hobbyists, collectors, and families. Hours are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday and 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday. Admission is $8. Children under 12 are admitted free with an adult. The fare is sponsored by the Decatur Civic Center, Wabash Railroad Historical Society, and Decatur Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, and all will be coordinated by Mary Traxler, who served as the event's very first coordinator in 1991. On to the Nation page on A3, U.S. is in kinda blue mood. Historian, think about liberty, equality, and the pursuit of happiness on sesquicentennial. Articles by Susan Page, USA Today. America is not in a party mood. Even as the United States approaches the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, a celebration of the founding of the world's oldest modern constitutional democracy, most Americans are mired in dissatisfaction with the nation's present and pessimism about its future. By double digits in recent polls, they predict the country's best years are behind us, with more peril than promise ahead. Despite a few glimmers of good feeling, today's fierce political divisions redefined a milestone that has often been marked by unity and optimism, at least for a moment. A cover of The New Yorker by Barry Bliss portrayed a dyspeptic George Washington, doused by confetti and holding a martini, the caption, "Red, white, and kinda blue." A half-dozen recent national surveys conducted by the Pew Research Center and Gallup, NBC News and Fox News, Elon University and Emerson College posed different questions but consistently shown an anxious nation that is nervously eyeing what will follow. That's not entirely new. In the past, the big anniversaries of the Declaration have been marked not only by celebration but also by protest and unease. In 1876, at the centennial, the United States was still recovering from a devastating civil war. At the official celebration at Independence Hall in Philadelphia, suffragist Susan B. Anthony marched on stage, uninvited, to present demands for women's rights to the gathered dignitaries. In 1976, the bicentennial followed the traumas of the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal that forced President Richard Nixon's resignation. Leading the celebrations was his successor, Gerald Ford, the only president who was never elected to national office as president or vice president. Many generations of Americans always took the founding as an opportunity to agitate for more rights, said Carol Faulkner, a historian at Syracuse University who had studied the commemorations. This might be a time of thinking about liberty, equality, and the pursuit of happiness. But in some ways, this time is different, she said. It's much more partisan. It's really much more about a divisive president than the 1876 or 1976 commemorations. Today's mood is more downbeat, too. During the bicentennial in 1976, 43% of those surveyed by Roper felt optimistic about the future of the country, compared with 15% who were pessimistic, the positive outnumbering the negative by 28 percentage points. 39% were uncertain. Now, in an Emerson College poll that asked the same question, pessimism jumped 26 points to 41%, while optimism had ticked down to 42%, overall a positive edge of a single point. 18% were uncertain. About 7 in 10 Americans, or 69%, told an Elon University poll that they believed the signers of the Declaration of Independence would feel more disappointment than pride about modern American democracy. Macon County Democrats, Central Committee Chairman reelected. Smith pledges to build his party back up. This article is by Scott Perry, Decatur. Brian E. Smith has been reelected chairman of the Macon County Democratic Central Committee for another 2-year term. Smith was reelected with 100% of the weighted vote of the committee persons present at the biannual county convention in April. On hand to swear in the newly elected Democratic precinct committee persons from across Macon County was Democratic Lieutenant Governor candidate Christian Mitchell. Since elected party chair in April 2024, Smith has kept his pledge to encourage and grow precinct committee persons, appointing 27 people to fill vacancies where needed in the county's 64 precincts. He had organized an annual fundraiser for the party and has supported efforts to make the party more visible in the community. "I am truly humbled and honored by your support," Smith said to the county convention. "I pledge to continue to work hard each and every day to earn your continued support and confidence as we move forward. Working together as a team, we can continue to build our party back." A former 18-year Macon County board member and former Long Creek Township supervisor and Long Creek Township clerk, Smith is a candidate for Macon County clerk in the November 3rd election. He also is the retired executive director, CEO of the Township Officials of Illinois, where he was employed for 35 years. He is a sixth-generation public servant in Macon County. National Mall, Washington, D.C. Trump targets pool vandals. President unknown chemical poured into reflecting pool. Articles by Drew Pittock, USA Today. For nearly 2 weeks, the recently renovated reflecting pool on the National Mall has grown algae blooms, and its new blue paint also has begun to peel off. Experts say the algae problem is likely a product of Mother Nature. President Donald Trump, meanwhile, says something more nefarious is afoot and that those who are responsible will be held accountable. Here's what we know about the alleged vandalism and arrests tied to the reflecting pool. "Alleged vandals arrested," Trump said. Trump wrote Friday on social media, without providing evidence, that vandals poured an unknown chemical into the reflecting pool to try to destroy and demean our beautiful work. "We've cleaned, renovated, and beautified over 45 monuments and memorials, 28 statues, and 22 fountains in Washington, D.C. Things are looking really good in our nation's capital," the social media post stated. "However, we've had some real problems with vandalism at the beautiful reflecting pool, which sits between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial." A day later, the president doubled down, saying many of the alleged vandals were arrested. "What these terrible vandals have done is a true affront to both Presidents George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and should be dealt with accordingly," Trump posted Saturday. He went on to claim that many additional people have been arrested in connection to the disgraceful vandalism of our beautiful reflecting pool. On Sunday, Trump claimed he personally visited the reflecting pool and described it as seriously vandalized, while calling those allegedly responsible sick, deranged people. "Work will begin immediately on fixing the seriously vandalized reflecting pool. I just inspected it and could only say to myself and those gathered around me, wow, who would do such a thing? Sick, deranged people. We will fix it," Trump wrote following his visit. The arrests, as of Sunday, the identity of one person who was arrested emerged. David Hearn, a former Olympic canoeist, was arrested by U.S. Park Police on Friday and charged with misdemeanor destruction of government property. The Washington Post first reported, Hearn did not immediately return USA Today's request to speak on Sunday. Hearn told the Post he reached into the reflecting pool and was able to grab the end of a flapping piece, but didn't remove it. I didn't vandalize anything, the 67-year-old told the outlet. I didn't destroy or break or peel anything. By the time I realized what was going on, I was being put in handcuffs. U.S. Park Police did not return USA Today's request for comment. Aside from Hearn, it's unclear who else was arrested or what charges they might face. The office of D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser declined to comment on the alleged arrests. Speaking to Peter Ducey on Fox News Sunday briefing, U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia Jeannie Pirro said that anyone who is in a position of vandalizing or attempting to vandalize the reflecting pool will face the criminal justice system in D.C. Onto the opinion page, A7, interesting article here, Graduates' Right to Cheer for AI, Actual Intelligence. This article's by Philomena V. Montella. Montella is president of Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. She wrote this for the Chicago Tribune. I was seated on stage at Grand Valley State University's commencement when Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak leaned into the microphone and reframed the entire conversation about artificial intelligence in 6 words. You all have AI, actual intelligence. The arena erupted. Not polite applause, genuine, full-throated cheering. From thousands of graduates who spent years being told AI was coming for their futures, what Wozniak gave them was something conspicuously missing from most public conversation about AI and work, a direct affirmation that human intelligence isn't a liability to be managed. It's the point. The moment didn't happen in isolation. This spring's commencement season produced a striking pattern. At the University of Central Florida, a speaker promoting AI was booed so overwhelmingly she stopped mid-speech. A CEO who told Middle Tennessee State Universities to deal with AI was jeered, then he taunted them, which made it worse. Former Google CEO Eric Schmidt was interrupted by roars of displeasure at the University of Arizona after invoking AI's inevitability. Most coverage has framed this as Gen Z anxiety or ingratitude, but a generation is telling us with unusual directness that the story they keep being told about their future is wrong, and the data is starting to agree with them. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York's 2025 labor market analysis found that recent philosophy graduates have lower unemployment rates than computer science graduates. Art history majors are more likely to be employed than computer engineering majors. The global management firm McKinsey calls the pattern reversed skill bias. Unlike prior automation waves, generative AI disproportionately displaces higher educated, knowledgeable workers. The jobs that generations of students were steered toward are among the most exposed. The learn to code consensus that shaped a decade of education policy was a reasonable forecast. The labor market has now revised it. What Wozniak understood and what the booed speakers kept missing is the distinction between labor and talent. Labor is the industrial era conception of human contribution, transactional, task-based, substitutable. It's what gets automated. Talent is something different. Judgment in novel situations, ethical reasoning under pressure, the ability to build trust across cultural difference, that contextual intelligence to ask the right questions rather than just optimize toward the assigned one. They're the capacities that become more valuable as AI becomes more capable. The market is already moving. Goldman Sachs' chief information officer suggested pairing computer science with philosophy is worth serious consideration. Microsoft's CEO noted that engineers now use AI to write 20% to 30% of their code, which raises the obvious question of what differentiates the engineers who remain? The answer is consistently human: judgment, communication, and the ability to define problems worth solving. The graduates booing this spring aren't anti-technology. They grew up with it. What they're rejecting is a specific posture, the one that treats their human capacities as a problem to be solved. For business leaders and employers, the lesson isn't complicated. The talent pipeline you're drawing from is full of people who already understand that their value isn't competing with AI, it's in complementing it. I'll say that again. The talent pipeline you're drawing from is full of people who already understand that their value isn't in competing with AI, it's in complementing it. Wozniak built one of the most consequential technologies of the modern era when he tells graduates that their actual intelligence is the thing that matters. He's not being sentimental, he's being precise. And the thousands of young people who cheered him knew it. The question for the rest of us is whether we've caught up. On the Nation and World E-Edition Plus and the Digest, Judge SNAP benefits can be used for suites, Washington. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. blocked the Trump administration Monday from preventing food stamp recipients in five states from using their benefits to buy sugary foods and drinks. U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson ruled that the U.S. Department of Agriculture lacked the authority under federal law to approve state requests to bar recipients of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, from using benefits to buy sugary food and drinks. She sided with five plaintiffs who argued the restrictions would undermine their access to food. The USDA has approved food restriction waivers in 23 states, allowing them to restrict SNAP participants from using their benefits to buy products such as soda and candy. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. endorsed the waivers. SNAP provides monthly benefits to 42 million low-income Americans. Prime Minister Starmer resigns. Orderly transfer of power is expected as Burnham likely next. Elizabeth Piper, Alastair Smoot, and Andrew McCaskill, Reuters, London. Prime Minister Keir Starmer said Monday he will step down, paving the way for what is expected to be an orderly transfer of power to frontrunner Andy Burnham, who could become Britain's seventh leader in 10 years as early as next month. In an emotional speech, Starmer said he listened to his governing Labour Party and realized that he was no longer the man who should lead it into a national election due in 2029. After making his announcement on the steps of his Downing Street office and London residence, Starmer's move to stand down could have triggered a divisive leadership contest, but several Labour lawmakers said they now expected more of a coronation. Burnham, a 56-year-old career politician, quickly won the support of another potential leadership rival, former Health Minister Wes Streeting, who was one Labour lawmaker saying it was more likely the former mayor would now be installed as leader. And that brings us to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour.